Our next speaker is a priest, an academic, and a broadcaster, among many other things. You can read him every week in The Guardian, hear him regularly on Radio 4 and elsewhere. And if you visit South London, you may well find him in his role as parish priest. Please welcome Giles Fraser.
Wonderful to be back at Greenbelt. I've been here a few years, but missed last year. I missed last year because when it moved from Cheltenham, I realised that the site of Greenbelt was going to be a mile from where my parents lived. More of that a little later. But I suppose it's not a coincidence that I've decided to talk about Freud. Freud and Augustine on the subject of helplessness. This is a talk I've never given before, and I only have it semi-clear in my head, so if you'll forgive me, this is an original contribution. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for probably about half an hour, 40 minutes, and then going to take some questions. And there's a microphone here where you're able to line up, and thank you. About 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I started undergoing psychotherapy, which was a wonderful adventure in my life. And at the same time as having a two-weekly session with the amazing Susie Orbach, who I love and saved my life, I also became friendly with another psychotherapist, became a mate called Adam Phillips. And it's my conversations that I had with Adam that have really provoked this reflection and talk. Adam's a Freudian psychoanalyst and takes a fairly standard line about Freud, that Freud and religion are incompatible. And in a sense, this is a response to Adam. But before we come to Freud, I want to distinguish two different sorts of religion, two different sorts of Christianity. One of which I think is rightly criticized by Freud, and one of which says, I think, remarkably similar things, but obviously from a different age and in a different idiom. Pelagius, they said, was fat, full of porridge, a Scottish or a northern layman who came down to Rome, end of the 4th century, just at that fascinating point in human history, where things are tipping from the ancient world until the Middle Ages. And he came down to Rome with a very simple message. The Rome I imagine he came down to was, and I have this in my head, that sort of I Claudius Rome of debauchery and orgies and people lying on chaise longues with grapes dangling in front of them. You know, the sort of caricature I have. That's what I have in my head as the Rome that Pelagius, the Christian ascetic, came down to Rome. And his message was this, simple. His favorite quote from the scriptures was, "Be ye perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And because God commanded that we could be perfect, he wouldn't command what we couldn't do. So perfection is entirely possible for human beings, according to Pelagius. And how you achieve this perfection is by obeying the rules. Christianity's got a whole set of rules, and you obey the rules, and if you obey the rules, you go to heaven. That's Pelagius for me in a nutshell. Now, at the same time as Pelagius, there is my great hero, St. Augustine. And St. Augustine thought that this was total bollocks. It's a technical term. He thought it was total bollocks because Augustine, as you know, had a shady, complicated past. He was a ladies' man. He had a relationship that lasted a long time with a child. He tells us in his confessions, though he never tells us her name. He stole when he was a kid. His mum liked to drink. He was a man who understood the complexities of life. And when he heard Pelagius's preaching, he was offended. He was offended because he knew that human beings were not like this, that they were not capable of the sort of perfection that Pelagius required of them, us. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. For Augustine, human beings are fundamentally broken creatures. And because we're broken and, essentially to my talk, unable to fix ourselves, we're not self-fixers, we require something other than ourselves to fix us. We require what he called grace. We require God. Now, I suppose Pelagius would think that he required God as well. But Pelagius's prescription, his understanding of Christianity, is basically that we sort of save ourselves. We're self-savers. Because if we do keep the rules, if we tick the boxes, then God's role is a sort of it's a glorified compliance officer, really. Is that when we turn up at the pearly gates, if we have ticked all the boxes, then God is required to let us in. We've done our part, now it's his turn to do his part. Augustine thought this was bad anthropology and also bad theology. It doesn't give God any saving work to do. For Augustine, we are fundamentally dependent creatures. We are dependent for fixing on that which is outside of our control. I'm going to say that again because I think it's so important. We are dependent for our fixing on something that is outside our control. We are vulnerable. And we are dependent upon this thing that we as Christians call grace. There's no grace in Pelagius. We don't require something outside of ourselves to fix ourselves. We are self-sufficient in our salvation. So, this Pelagian Christianity was declared, best thing Christianity ever did, was declare this heretical. And yet, I suspect that Pelagian Christianity is still the most popular form of Christianity that there is. Keep the rules, tick the boxes, and there will be eternal consequences for you. For Augustine, we can't do it. We're too complicated. We have this thing called original sin. Original sin gets a very bad rap. Original sin gets a bad rap because people think it's about some hang-up that Christians have with sex. And it's true that Augustine was indeed sex-obsessed. But actually, original sin is something like a way of talking about fundamental human brokenness, that we cannot fix ourselves and that we need something outside of ourselves to fix ourselves. Maybe the best model, popular model, of Augustinian Christianity is Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always thought of churches as being, at their best, a bit like Alcoholics Anonymous. You turn up to this community of people who want to support each other, and the first thing you have to do is you have to confess your inability to do it on your own. That's the first thing you have to do. I cannot fix myself. I am unable to do this without help. You have to ask for help. And they try and secularize this model as much as possible by talking about a higher power. But basically, it's an Augustinian model of church, Alcoholics Anonymous. We turn up in this body of people who are all, as it were, there for the medicine, there for the healing, supporting each other and asking for help, acknowledging our vulnerability, acknowledging our dependency, acknowledging our helplessness. Helplessness. What Freud said is that Christianity is a program of denying our helplessness, of getting a big daddy in the sky to fix it for us. I think he misunderstands Christianity. Freud talks, like Augustine, a lot about babies and childhood and Pelagius. And for Freud, the trauma, and that's not too strong a word, of being a child, of being a baby, is, and listen to this phrase because it's so like Augustine, we're unable to be in control of the sources of our own satisfaction. That's the thing about a baby. The baby is unable to be in control of the sources of his or her own satisfaction. So the breast, the mother, the source of life, is either there or not there, but it's not subject to the child's will. The child cries, the child screams. Suddenly, the trauma is that I cannot control my own satisfaction. I cannot satisfy myself. I am dependent and wholly vulnerable on that which is other, the mother. Freud says that life is a recovery from childhood, from the trauma of childhood, from the trauma of a recognition that we are not able to satisfy ourselves, that we are helpless as a child. He calls this, and think of this connection with original sin, he calls this, and this is his quote, original helplessness. We are originally helpless. And this helplessness is so traumatic that we spend a lot of our lives developing strategies to mitigate the panic that this creates in us. Two strategies. One strategy is to deny the fact that we have those needs, the needs that can be unmet. I don't need you. I don't care about other people. There's a little story, just to tell a little story, just have something in your mind. A child wants to play Lego with his dad. Dad says, I can't at the moment. I've got to make this important phone call. And the child goes, oh, don't worry then. I didn't want to play Lego in the first place. Silly little story. What's going on? Don't worry then. I didn't want to play Lego in the first place. Of course the child wants to play Lego. But the But by being told you can't do it now, the child is facing the fact that he or she is not in control of the sources of their own satisfaction. Someone else has to do it with them, for them. They are dependent creatures. And the child's response in this story is to deny their need. I didn't want to do it in the first place. To deny their vulnerability. The whole thing about therapy is a way of exposing the way we often sabotage ourselves, sabotage our own needs and desires through various sorts of fear. Here's a classic instance. The child sabotages his or her own fear to play Lego, a desire to play Lego, because they're frightened of facing their own vulnerability of being dependent upon someone else for the satisfaction of that need. So that's one strategy of dealing with helplessness, vulnerability. Pretend we don't have it. And you see tons of people like that. Incredibly well-defended people. People who do not express or show or are comfortable with their need for other people, their need for that which is other. Another strategy is to acknowledge your need, but try and bully the world into meeting it. That's generally my strategy. So, I need you to do X. You're not going to do X. Well, I'm bloody well going to make sure you do X. So, you become a sort of control freak, controlling the world so the world is there to meet your will. Again, because we are profoundly frightened by, because we've been traumatized by, this thing that Freud calls original helplessness. And some parents with their children are also frightened about it on their own behalf. When some mothers overfeed their children, I know what you're thinking. When some mothers overfeed their children, one of the things that that can be about is trying to stop the child desiring, because the desiring, carrying with it the consequence that the desire will not be met, is so traumatic for the child. So you bung up the child, fill the child's desires, fill it up before they even start. Eat before you're even hungry. You're terrified of desire, because desire carries with it the possibility that the desire will not be met. And so, strangely, there can be strategies against us desiring, us wanting. The fear of helplessness can be the beginnings of a hostility to desire. And these days, just an aside, we're really phobic about desiring something but not having it. We're always wanting the desire and the desire being met to happen one really quickly. We're terrified of having a desire without. I mean, this is our shopping thing. This is our filling us up, unable. I'm talking about me. I've never been able to go on retreats or sit silently or not be within 500 yards of a coffee shop or a restaurant. Terrifies me that I might have, and so I'm entirely a product of my time, fearing your own desire. So, one of the things that Freud also says, which is brilliant, he says the original helplessness, which he describes, let me quote, as the terrifying impression of helplessness in childhood, the terrifying fear that the child is not able to satisfy their own cravings, is, he says, the beginnings of all morality. It's the beginnings of all morality. I think he's right about this. Because what it makes you realize is my need for others and their need for me. And that all human beings come stamped with fragile, handle with care. That we're not omnipotent. That's the great heresy of Pelagius. The great heresy of Pelagius is that Pelagius wants human beings to be entirely in control of themselves, that we are all powerful. That's the fantasy that is consequent, the common fantasy that is consequent upon our fear of helplessness, our fear of fragility, that we are... I'm losing all my notes here, they're blowing away. It doesn't matter, I'll just make it up. I'm going to give you two examples of this, this fear of vulnerability. And they're going to be in the classic areas, if you like, of sex and death. I was writing about this the other day, and I apologize for what's to come next. I'll try and euphemize it as much as I can. I was writing about Pelagian sex. And I said, the Pelagian ideal of sex is masturbation. What I mean by that is auto-satisfaction. Because the fear of sex, and this is related to Freud, the fear of sex is the fear of exposure and vulnerability. That one is inherently vulnerable in so deep a way to the other to have our needs met. For Pelagius, auto-satisfaction is... I'm obviously calling Pelagius a very rude word here, if you understand me. Auto-satisfaction is how we ought to be satisfied. Isn't it interesting that that word satisfaction can carry such a sexual charge, but can also carry a charge about... a theological charge, that it's often a word used for salvation. For Freud, no helplessness, no satisfaction. Unless you are prepared to be vulnerable and helpless, ask for your needs to be met, then they can't actually be met. The thing about the Pelagian vision, the auto-satisfaction, auto-salvation, fear of helplessness, is actually, it's a plot against desire in the end. Because it wants to stop you desiring. It wants to stop you desiring because you might desire things that you can't have, or you might desire people that won't want you, or you might desire things that will thwart you. Think about this with regard to God. Any sort of desire carries with itself the possibility that that desire will be unmet. And so, and that's constitutive of the human condition, Freud says. Absolutely ineluctable. We're shot through with that. We can't do anything about it. Because if we want something, then that could be frustrated. So the thing that can always meet our desire, we will always have an ambivalence about. We will always have an ambivalence about that which can meet our desire. Whether that be God or your partner or whatever, we will have a structural ambivalence. We will love and hate the thing that we love and hate. We will love and hate the thing that we love and hate because We are aware that though this can satisfy us, this can also frustrate us, that our desires can be unmet. And so we will always have a profoundly ambivalent relationship to parents, to partners, and to God. That's sex. Death. It's possible I might cry in a minute. Last night, as I told you, I live a mile up the road. My parents live in Slipton, if you pass through that on the way. I was in their cottage in Slipton last night. My mum sometimes reads my Guardian pieces. She didn't today or yesterday. She didn't read it online yesterday. She said, I haven't stayed at home for quite a while, so we nice shepherd's pie. She sat me down and she said, darling, I need to tell you something. I've decided when the time comes, I want to go to Dignitas. This was last night. And I don't know if you've read my Guardian piece today. My Guardian piece today was all about how opposed I am to assisted dying. And I was really quite taken aback. I didn't quite know how to respond to this. And my mum started trying to describe what it was that she so feared, such that she'd want to go to Switzerland. She described us going down to, when we have a lovely trip, we could all go down and have a big party all the way down, she said. And we could have lots of nice restaurants, and then you could come back, bring my ashes back. She said, don't bring them back in a Tesco's bag, bring them back in a Harrods bag, she said. It's like the bizarre conversations you have. And she said, darling, my mum's really house proud, really, really house proud. And she said, darling, I couldn't lie in bed and not have your father put the curtains right. I was just like, bloody hell, Mum. What? There was a load of other things, but that's the thing that stuck in my head. It's just, I couldn't lie there and the house not be right and the weeds growing up in the garden and all that. I couldn't lie there if I was vulnerable. I couldn't lie there. I couldn't cope with my needs being unmet. I couldn't cope with the fear of that vulnerability. I couldn't cope almost with the fear of returning to what it's like to be a child when you're not in control of the sources of your own satisfaction. It seems to me that assisted suicide is another response to that fear of vulnerability, the fear of vulnerability as a child, or the fear of vulnerability that we might have when our powers begin to leave us. And at the heart of this, these days, is a model of liberal individualism in which we are persuaded to be and celebrated as individual units that look after ourselves. Self-satisfiers. It's the ultimate triumph of Pelagian ethics. I just don't want to live in a world like that. I want to live in a world in which I look after you and you look after me. And that's extremely vulnerable because you might not look after me and because I might not look after you. But actually, I want to be a bloody burden on my family when I get old. And actually, I want my mum to be a bloody burden on me when she does. Freud was right about helplessness. No helplessness, no knowledge of helplessness, no ultimate satisfaction. Unless I ask you for help, you are not going to help me. Unless I ask you to be my lover, you are not going to be my lover. Unless I ask you to feed me, you're not going to feed me. If I pretend that those needs don't exist, they won't be met. I mean, I don't have to actually ask, but I have to acknowledge, I have to understand my own vulnerability. And the same is true of God. There's times when I have lost sight of God, but I have never lost sight of my need for God. Happy are those who know their need of God. The kingdom of heaven is theirs. Happy are those who know their need of God. Need, you need him. You need God. That's why Pelagian Christianity is rubbish. You don't really need him. Just do the things you're told to do, tick the boxes, and all will be well. I think today Christians are profoundly countercultural. Profoundly countercultural because we are a group of people who generally, on the whole, do not accept the individuality, the self-satisfying, self-healing model of the self that is so prevalent in our culture. A model that is built on fear. Fear that you won't look after me, so I have to look after myself. A fear of dependency. A fear that goes right to the heart of what it is to be a human being. A fear that's there in the relation between the infant child and the breast. A fear that's there in the elderly and whether they're cared for. And we as a group, I think, have to say, we will care for you. And I do want you to care for me. And that second bit's really important. Expressing our need, expressing our vulnerability, expressing our helplessness. Augustine was so bloody right. We are not self-fixers. We cannot save ourselves. We require this thing called grace. And we are asked, we are called to be agents of God's grace to each other. We come stamped with this mark, fragile handle with care. And our mission is to be that grace to each other whereby we don't retreat into a world. Mum, I will fix your curtains. I will try and fix your curtains. I may not always fix your curtains, but it's okay. It's okay to live with our needs not always being met, not being instantly met. Sometimes there is a deferral. I can't play Lego with you. I have to take a phone call. But I will play Lego with you. But ultimately, we have to be there for each other in order for us to acknowledge our own fragility and vulnerability. Helplessness is not a curse, it's a gift. Helplessness is not a curse, it's a gift. And that's the mission, that's our mission as Christians, to say this to the world. Our fragility as human beings is not a curse, it's a gift. And it's that by which we say to each other, I need you. Happy are those who know their need of God. The kingdom of heaven is theirs. Thank you. So, thank you for that applause. There's a microphone there. If you start to sort of think about things you might say, I'm quite happy for you to ask me about that, and I'll probably go off in some other disquisition or about anything that you want to ask me. We have a period of time, so please will some bold person come up and start it off, or otherwise I'm going to have to sing to you or something. Go on, well done. Round of applause to this person. It's like...
Okay, so I think you're very brave having met Suvi Orbach once and then going back twice a week. She's a scary person. My question is about forgiveness. How does the Freudian model of forgiveness help us and disable us in comparison to the model of Christianity, the forgiveness that we are freely given by God? And what are your personal experiences of that?
Wow. Okay, start to queue up when I do forgive. I'll have words about forgiveness. If you'll excuse me, I'm going to say what I think about forgiveness and where I think we get forgiveness right and wrong, rather than talk specifically about... I know Freud hates... I think forgiveness is at the heart of the Christian enterprise, but I think we get it wrong because we think forgiveness is something that's internal. So I promise you that if any of you did anything nasty to any of my children, I would never, quote, unquote, forgive you. And what I mean by that is I would never have nice, fuzzy, warm feelings about you. I don't think that's possible for me to have. And because of that impossibility, many people think that forgiveness can't actually happen. It doesn't make sense that there's... It's a sort of alibi against forgiveness. I'm sure there are people here who may well be able to do that, but I promise you I couldn't. But that doesn't mean to me that I couldn't forgive you, because I think forgiveness is a much more empirical thing. Forgiveness is the opposite of revenge. That's what it is to me. And so, not an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but you forgive. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is you do X to me, I do X to you back. There's some reciprocity, that's revenge, the lex talionis. And I think that forgiveness is a refusal of revenge. So you do X to me, I don't return the favour in kind. I refuse to model your behaviour. I refuse to do to you what you do to me. I can think all sorts of things about you. I can feel all sorts of things about you. But forgiveness is breaking a cycle of tit-for-tat violence. You do this to me, I do this to you, you do this to me, I do this to you. That sort of cycle that we see all over. Forgiveness is, I will not imitate you. I will not imitate the violent other. I will do the imitation of Christ. I will do some completely different thing. I will refuse revenge. Now, what actually that means, and I think this is a very realistic model, it means, A, I've got no alibi not to do it. It's not that I can do that. I don't know how I could have warm, fuzzy feelings about you if you harmed my children. But I could, and I pray would, not return and do the same to you. It isn't an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I wouldn't respond like that. So there's no alibi in this model of forgiveness not to do it. There's no, I couldn't really do that. The other thing that explains is why churches are very odd places. I think, you know when people always say, oh, you go to church and there's always those undercurrents, all that sort of, you know, people slightly at each other's throats, and there's that nice Christian smile, but behind it they don't really bloody mean it, and it's a den of vipers, really. I agree. They're really often like that. We all know they're often like that. And that's sort of okay. And it's also a consequence of us doing our Christianity properly. Because if I forgive you, if I forgive you, I still may well harbour all sorts of complicated feelings about you. Complicated feelings about you. My word, even the people who've done the best sort of forgiveness, you'd love to sit in their psychotherapy and see what's going on. I won't ever have those warm, fuzzy feelings. And so those warm, fuzzy feelings may well exist in some subterranean way, some psychological way, but they are a sort of epiphenomena, a consequence of a triumph that's already achieved that I actually haven't hit you back. You hit me. I don't hit you back. That's what I call forgiveness. I don't hit you back. I break that cycle of revenge, of reciprocity. That's the triumph. And the cost of that triumph is that I'm going under my breath like Muttley, as it were, inside towards you. Okay. But Nietzsche, who's one of my great heroes, thinks it should be the other way around. Thinks that the way to have the happy soul, the happy greenbelt soul, as it were, is to hit back. Because if you hit me and I hit you back, I don't hate you. It's all gone. It's all been exercised. I can have the happy greenbelt soul if I punch you back. Well, I would prefer not to punch you back and not have the happy greenbelt soul. So that's a very long and complicated answer, the beginnings of an answer about forgiveness. Sort of Girardian answer, if you like. I can't see how many people are there, so there are a couple of people. Right, okay, good.
This isn't a question as such, but it's an encouragement to everyone. When I heard you talking about your mum and death, our mother-in-law lived with us and sadly passed away 4 weeks ago, and we nursed her through the last 3 months with cancer. She was frayed. She was a Christian lady, and we're Christians. But through all of our vulnerability, we had the closest times of prayer and the closest times of opening ourselves up to get everything said that needed to be said over the years. And a member of family managed to seek forgiveness for a 30-year bad relationship. So that time where she was most vulnerable was the time when God brought us closest to each other and closest to him. And so I just want to encourage everybody here that if you're in that position, use it as a gift and thank God for that time, because it is a blessing. Don't run away from it.
That's so exactly what I was trying to say in my talk. Thank you so much for doing that. You know the wonderful Stanley Hauerwas, one of my great heroes, Stanley Hauerwas, talks about, if you ask people now how they want to die, they say they want to die quickly, painlessly, and in their sleep. And if you go back into the Middle Ages, or even the litany, it says, God save us from blah, 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 and dying unprepared. You know that bit in the save us from dying unprepared. And the reason that the quick death was so fearful to many people in the Middle Ages, Hauerwas says, and I think he's right, is because there are things that you can do in that time that this woman's just talked about. You say sorry to your family. You say, I love you. You use that time to do all the sorts of things. Hauerwas says it's brilliant. He says, you say sorry to your enemies. You say sorry to your family, who often are your enemies. He says, it's just so typical of him. It's absolutely brilliant. But you deal with all of that stuff. It is a time. Exactly right. At the times of most intense vulnerability and helplessness, we can be more real to each other than at any other times. And because we're so phobic about that, we want to cut it off. I think the dying is, the situation about dying is an exact example of what I was talking about. My mum said to me this morning, can I come and hear your talk? I said, it's 50 quid to get into Greenbelt, mum. She's not here.
Hi, it's a question about, can we sometimes be a bit too Augustinian and this sort of miserable worm, I'm a sinner,
and
we can be disabled by that, and that there should, you know, we'd be reminded more of grace and more of Athanasius and that kind of stuff.
You see, that's a really, thank you for asking that question. Yes, all that Book of Common Prayer, we're not worthy to, you know, all that sort of stuff. Do you know, I mean, I may have got Augustine wrong, or I may just be trying to shift him into something more acceptable. But I don't read it like that. So I try and talk not about us being, I'm some miserable worm. You know, I'm completely and utterly bloody useless. But I'm broken. There's a sort of existential brokenness which I'm unable to fix, and I need you to fix it. It's a sort of saying, I need your help. So I'm not really saying about myself that I am. It's not a disparagement of the human condition to say that it is constitutive of the human condition that we ask for help and that we're unable to fix ourselves. And that's the bad rap that original sin often gets, that it's somehow a disparagement of the human condition. It feels to me entirely not a disparagement if what it really is an acknowledgement of our vulnerability and our helplessness and our inability to fix ourselves and our asking God and others, I think, I'm broadening it, to be the ones that, you know, I'm inviting, asking for, requiring, interceding, to be made whole, to make the person that I should be or want to be or whatever that is. I don't think that's a disparagement of the human to acknowledge our vulnerability. In fact, the opposite. Because if human beings are constitutively vulnerable, then acknowledging that is a, I think we need to celebrate. I mean, I think we need better models. I think we need better models of our in our culture of vulnerable human beings. Better models of sometimes us being frustrated and not having instantly to be sorted out. We need strong models of vulnerability, if that makes any sense at all. So it's not a, I hope it's not a disparagement of the human. And I feel a bit like that. You can get that in the Book of Common Prayer when we're always sort of sucking up to a, you know, Tudor monarch and saying how rubbish I am. Certainly, that's not my relationship with God. But there again, I don't really want to go down that idea that I'm so unbelievably perfect that I don't need you or God or anybody else. Because that seems to me a fantasy about who we are. So, sort of yes, but I think this Augustinian thing, and I think our need for grace, needs to be reclaimed from its association with a anthropology which seemed to disparage the human. I'm vulnerable and I want to celebrate myself as such.
Thank you. I wonder if, please, if I could ask you to say something about prayer, and maybe specifically intercessory prayer, as an expression of our helplessness and dependence and need for God. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Look, I'm quite bad at prayer. I've always, I don't know if you heard, I did Thought for the Day this week, I think it was earlier this week on Tuesday. And I was always very glad of Rowan Williams's image about prayer as sunbathing, which is, I mean, I suppose this fits in with the theology of grace, which is, you know, when it comes to sunbathing, you lie back and it doesn't matter how much effort you put in, how much you screw up your eyes, and like it's something that's done to you. You know, you don't get any browner or less, but what you have to do is you have to take off your clothes, i.e. you have to be vulnerable. And you have to find the source of light. You have to lie in the light. You have to find the truth. And I think there's a sort of, I mean, I think I could do a thing on Freud and Augustine about taking off your clothes and lying in the truth type of thing. And if that intercession at that time is a form of help me, help us, help them. I mean, my problem with intercessory prayer is just the obvious one, which is I don't really like the idea of it some sort of cosmic lobbying or giving God a shopping list of things that he already knows about. I think the important thing is thy will be done, not my will be done. I think it's about how God changes me, not how I change God. But there will be those who have a different model than me, but that's where I would go. But I think the most important thing that the sunbathing image insists upon is that it's something that you can't, you have to give it time. You can't short circuit. You have to, it isn't something you could go really quickly and just like put in your requests and then, no, you have to lie in the sun. You have to lie in the light and you have to be changed by that light and it changes you.
Hi, and thanks for everything you said. It was just incredibly helpful and just the right moment to say it. Just thanks.
Oh, thank you, Wilf.
But I just want to say, in the same way that another person has brought up the different readings of Augustine, I just want to make a wee plea for different readings of Pelagius as well.
Oh, okay.
Because
there we go.
Oh,
good.
My very rudimentary understanding of Pelagius, but for me, many years ago...
You're Scottish, aren't you?
I am.
Ah. This is a little bit of... This is special pleading. Go on.
But the first reading of Pelagius, which was introduced to me many years ago now, that I find a profoundly liberating moment for me, I could take that reading of Pelagius, and it's totally compatible with everything that you've said this morning, and it's not a sort of, you know, mutually exclusive thing at all. So just a wee plea, you can say everything you've said, and you don't need to knock Pelagius, because for me, what Pelagius was saying was that We are fundamentally good. The greatest truth about us is the image of God within us. What we need the grace for is to restore us to seeing that. It's this problem of we've lost sight of it. And that was what Pelagius was saying. It brings us back and restoring that sense. And we do need grace and we do need God. And it's not that, you know, God is out there and we need this. It's an internal thing that needs reawakened. And that's my understanding. And that might sound heretical to you. But it's just to say that everything that you've said is compatible with other readings of Pelagius.
Well, let's... What can I say to that? I won't do a sort of scholarly back and forward, because that's... I mean, we can't do a back and forward. So I'm glad you sort of agree with the fundamental point. Do you know what? You see, the thing about Augustine, why I like Augustine, and why I have a problem with Pelagius, is like, look, I'm a bastard. And what I love about Augustine is he's a bastard too. And he does Christianity for bastards. And I sort of love that. And that's what I sort of need. And when I read Augustine, and when I read Pelagius, he doesn't seem to acknowledge that. It's very interesting. I try to... I'm in the process of writing an autobiography, trying to write a sort of spiritual autobiography sort of thing. It's taken me a long time, and I'm in the middle of it. And Augustine is always there as the person who wrote the Confessions, wrote that first, you know, first great act of autobiography. And if you go back before Augustine to those sort of self-writing, what the Greeks and the Romans basically did is they bigged themselves up. You know, aren't I marvellous? I am fantastic. That's what self-writing was about. And with Augustine, because he knows that he doesn't have to be that person in order to be saved, his writing is so much more honest. I mean, that's why he sort of invents autobiography. He invents autobiography precisely because he breaks from Pelagianism into this new, so that he actually goes, I can tell you about my complex relationship with women, or at least hint at them. I can tell you about my childhood and my stealing. I can tell you a line like, you know, God give me continence, but not yet. I mean, what a fantastically honest, complicated prayer that is. I can't hear Pelagius praying that prayer. Now, I may be wrong about Pelagius, but in a way, this is more important than the actual reputations of people who lived a long time ago and we've never met and all of that. We're actually talking about sort of archetypes, or I'm talking about archetypes. This is not a work of scholarship. This is an attempt to illuminate something about the present. And if there are Pelagian scholars out there for whom I've got that slightly wrong, apologies, but that's not really... the core of it is, I think, Augustinian Christianity allows for a form of honest self-presentation. Almost something like, only grace makes autobiography possible. Honest, semi-honest.
Hi.
Slam.
Yeah, it's quite loud. I was just wondering if you thought there was a point at which an acceptance of our own fragility can be unhealthy, and if so, at what point that balance shifts?
Well, is that a feminist question?
No.
Okay. Because I could see how it could be a feminist question.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking. Could you give me a hook for that? Because I could have said something in relation to that, but...
Yeah, no.
Do you mean
it's
something?
More because it's sort of the opposite of the going to Switzerland, I guess, is that when people get stuck in a cycle quite early on in their lives of needing help and being, I don't want to say being weak in a negative way, but there's sort of the reverse of that situation.
There's a celebration of a certain sort of weakness. That's why I thought it could be a feminist question, because there's a sort of like, because there is something quite right about us claiming power and sort of strength and so forth. I just think that there's a complicated dynamic, which I tried to say, which is that if we're going to celebrate the human and the celebrate human condition, I think we ought to be strong enough to acknowledge how weak we are. And that actually, I don't think that's a position of weakness. I think that's an actual position of strength. And so there's a complicated thing, isn't it? I mean, I have terrible alpha male tendencies, which I confess I do, and people who read me know that I comes out of my, I can be aggressive and all these sorts of things. So I'm not a sort of caricature, weak sort of, that's not, but maybe that's not relevant. But there's something about having a, there's something about having power and having the right sort of power, which is, it seems to me, entirely consistent with an acknowledgement of who we are as human beings and our vulnerability. And that seems to me to people who are comfortable in their skins. And that's a... You know, the flip side is there are people who never acknowledge their vulnerability because they want to have this illusion of uber-confidence and so forth. And actually, they sort of look quite pathetic. And it actually... It has a sort of veneer of powerful self... satisfying, I don't need anybody else. And actually there's something really quite sad about that sort of... But it's a very complicated area that can't be... Now, I think there's an interesting dynamic about it, that there is something that you do... what St. Paul is, strength in weakness. I mean, that's not a... And there's a genuine form of strength in weakness.
The vulnerability that you...
This has got to be the last one, right. Since a minute or two, I've got...
The vulnerability that you've described seems to be a community-building thing. Oh, sorry.
No, anybody else in the queue? I didn't see there was anybody behind you. I'll talk afterwards. Right. I'm really sorry, it's just a time thing.
And I read an excellent book called The Stature of Waiting, in which the author describes
Vanston.
How an old community moves into two tower blocks. And one tower block is not working, and the other tower block has formed community. And it turns out that in the second tower block, there's a woman with children who is disabled, unable to manage in that situation. And that was the core of the community that grew in that tower block, which the other one missed. And I wonder, is vulnerability always at the heart of community? Can anything form in community without vulnerability?
Oh, bloody hell. Sorry, Martin Rowe. I don't think there can be community without vulnerability, actually. I don't think you can do that without actually exposing our need for each other. I mean, I think that's the core of what I want to say, is that I need you and you need me. And on the core of that, we have our solidarity and our togetherness. And if, however, I present as not needing you, and you present as not needing me, and that we are simply individuals living out our own lives independently of each other because we don't need each other, then I don't see what community looks like in those circumstances. I just finished with a story that was, there's a lady called Maud who lives around the corner from me on the New Kent Road, and she's 90. Her partner died a few years ago, and she says, I don't know anybody around here. Nobody looks after me anymore. And that sort of vulnerability was just entirely not met by her community. And it seems to me that whatever the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven means with us, it's actually us all caring for and looking after each other, including you, my mother. Thank you very much indeed.